I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl.
73 seconds after launch, something unthinkable happened to the Space Shuttle Challenger.
Obviously a major malfunction.
We could not believe what we were seeing. The Challenger Legacy.
Join us as we uncover what really happened.
Listen now by searching Science Friction on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Sita Walker grew up in Toowoomba, west of Brisbane. She was the youngest, much-loved member of her family, especially adored by her grandma and her three aunts. Sita's family all belonged to the Baha'i faith, and growing up, Sita prayed to God every morning and every night and did her best to be good. She got married young to another Baha'i, became a mum to three kids, worked a regular and responsible job teaching high school. But despite following all the rules, life had some big surprises in store for Sita. And going through them, she discovered the exhilaration of making her own choices. Sita had the chance to replace what she had been taught was right with what she wanted. It turns out what she wanted, including eating biscuits first thing in the morning, falling in love, and writing. Her first book was the memoir, The God of No Good, and her new book is a novel called In a Common Hour. Hi, Sita.
Hi, Sarah.
If you close your eyes, Sita, and think about that house in Toowoomba, what do you see?
I see the hallway with all the rooms coming off it, and I see the family room, which was attached to the kitchen. We sort of had two family rooms. We had one good lounge, and my dad had his bookshelves in the good lounge, and there was a piano in the good lounge, and we were never really meant to go into the good lounge because my father had sort of said, look, we need just one space in this house that isn't overrun with family and children and things. So I have a family room attached to the kitchen, which was really the heart of the home, and that's where we lived most of the time.
What things was your mum, Faree, in charge of at home? What was her domain?
Mum was, that's a really interesting question. What was mum in charge of? I remember my grandmother doing most of the cooking when I was very young, before she sort of got too old to take on that job. So my grandmother was a constant fixture in the kitchen, cooking and in the garden, gardening and just pottering. She potted everywhere. And my mother went to work. So my mother was a school teacher like me, and she taught year two at Toowoomba East State School for probably about 30 years. And so she knows everybody in town and has people coming up to her saying, oh, Mrs. Walker, you taught me in 1991 or whatever. And she's, of course, got no idea who they are. But so my grandmother sort of looked after me, looked after the kids, and my mum worked, I think.
Was she good in a crisis, your mum, the sort of little domestic crisis that happen in a family all the time?
Well, strangely, as relaxed as the woman is, so she's relaxed about everything to do with the home. So she would never be the type of mother that would tidy up if guests were coming over. You know, if guests were coming, they were coming to see us exactly how we are, which is why my dad insisted on the good lounge. But Mum was the polar opposite of that. She was really happy to have anyone there. And if you walked through the door, you know, she'd be sitting on the lounge with a cup of tea and she'd probably throw a grape at you or something. And you're instantly part of the family, part of the team. And that's one of her very special gifts, I think, is to make anybody feel like they are close family. She would treat, you know, she would treat the Queen the same way that she would treat the ironing lady. And that's in her bones to be like that.
So apart from his focus on the good lounge, what kind of presence was your dad at home?
So Dad is a very particular man. He's a very principled man. My father would do all the things that he felt required attention to detail. And that's why we had an ironing lady in the end, because he couldn't do all the ironing. He didn't have time, and Mum doesn't care if your shirt's wrinkled. So he would hang the clothes out on the line. in a very particular fashion with the pegs, and he taught us all how to do it so that we wouldn't waste the pegs and so that everything would dry as efficiently as possible. He would alphabetize the bookshelf. He had a very neat and tidy study, which we were not allowed to go into, where his CDs were all lined up in genres. Dad's a big reader. He loves philosophy. He's an accountant.
It seems from reading your book, Sita, that he's really an affectionate father. What term does he use to describe you?
He is an affectionate father, yes. He calls me his precious treasure, and he always has done since I was very small. And maybe he was offsetting the fact that my brother would always tell me what an accident I was, and he always would say, oh, no, no, she was a pleasant surprise.
How did your mum and dad meet one another?
My mum and dad met at a Baha'i conference in Sydney in the mid-60s, I think 1966, and at that time it was very unusual for mixed-race couples to marry, but my father, being the principled man that I have just said that he is, really wanted to show his principles in his relationship. So he's told me that he always wanted to marry someone that was of a different race to him, because the Baha'is believe that there should be no prejudice between races and that everybody is equal, which nowadays we think, yeah, all right, of course. But in the 60s, you know, we were still in white Australia policy times, and it was very unusual for them to be together.
So your mum came from a Baha'i family, but your father converted, which would have been very unusual for a white Christian man to do. What drew him to Baha'i? How did that happen?
Yes, well, his father became a Baha'i first. His father became a Baha'i, and that caused a real rift in the marriage between his mother and his father, because his mother was not a Baha'i. She was a Christian, and she didn't like what she called this Baha'i shindig. She was the opposite to my mother in a way. She was very much about what will people think. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Sometimes it's good to think about what other people might think. But her husband, my grandfather, became a Baha'i, and my father would find Baha'i books that his father had hidden away because his mother wouldn't let them be out in the home. But he would find them and read them, and he was really taken with the philosophy of the religion.
What was it about the tradition, do you think, that really spoke to your father that led him to make that conversion against his mother's wishes and against the sort of norm in Australia at the time?
Well, he tells me that he read a book, a Baha'i book called The Book of Certitude, and he says that he was taken with the principles of the Baha'i faith, which is essentially that the prophet founder of the Baha'i faith, whose name is Baha'u'llah, was the latest in a line of divine messengers from God. And the Baha'is see that every religion has come from the same God, so they believe in the unity of religion and the unity of God, and they believe that those divine messengers or manifestations of God on earth have come in different times to teach humanity a message from God for that particular time in the development of humanity. So he really liked that idea, the idea of the oneness of religion and the oneness of mankind.
So how did that family background and that connection with the Baha'i religion compare with your mother and her experiences in her family?
Well, my mother was born into a Baha'i family. My mother was born in Iran, but when she was very young, my grandfather died in Iran, and my grandmother moved her children back to India because my grandmother had lived in India. And then her son, my uncle, grew up, and he met a Baha'i woman in India from Australia called Joan. And he went back to Australia with Joan, and they got married. And that's how my family, my mother's side of the family, ended up coming to Australia, because my grandmother wanted to see her son.
So you grew up then, Sita, in a family that was Baha'i. How much of your life at home centred around the faith?
Baha'is have what's called a 19-day feast, which is our sort of version of going to church. So every 19 days, Baha'is will go and meet. And we don't really have churches. We have temples, but our temples are vast and grand. And so there's only one in Australia. It's in Sydney. But we would just meet at a Baha'i centre, which was a house. And there would be prayers, and then there would sort of be an administrative portion of the meeting. And then we would have, you know, supper, something to eat. So we would do that every 19 days, and we would dress up for that like you would dress up to go to church, I suppose. And on Sundays, we would sort of go for Sunday prayers, and I would go to a Sunday school class, which was really like a virtues class, really. And it was called Rose Garden. That's just come back to me now. I haven't thought about Rose Garden for years, but it was called Rose Garden, which is quite cute. So I would go to Rose Garden.
Appropriate for Toowoomba as well.
Yes, absolutely.
And what sort of virtues were given priority?
Well, there's lots of them. Love, obviously, justice, peace, mercy.
What sense of God did you have in all those prayers? Did you have an idea of who you were praying to? What sort of entity or being?
I didn't have an idea as in an image, because Baha'is don't believe that God is an image. So we don't believe there's a masculine presence with a long white beard sitting on a cloud. They believe that God is an unknowable essence. So I didn't really have a picture, but I just had the feeling that I needed to do the right thing. So Fari was very concerned with the inside. So what's happening on someone's inside? Are they making the right choices? Are they using their virtues? Are they praying in the morning and praying in the evening? Are they truthful? Truthfulness. Oh my gosh, I just remembered my mother's voice. It came to me. She always says truthfulness is the foundation of all human virtues. So I was very concerned with being truthful. Also, Baha'is believe that backbiting is a great sin. So gossip and backbiting, which was a problem for me because I love gossip. So I really focused on trying to do the right thing and say the right thing and say my prayers in the morning and in the evening and always be looking at the day as it passed and thinking, did I do well or did I do ill, as Steinbeck writes. I have that quote in my head for some reason. So I was actively trying to be a good person.
Were there many other Baha'i in Toowoomba?
There were a few other Baha'i children. I think at my school, when I went to primary school, there was one other who I'm still very good friends with today. She's a dear friend of mine. But we were definitely the odd ones out. And I didn't like that. I certainly didn't like telling people that I was a Baha'i, but I would do it because as a Baha'i, you're meant to be proud of the fact that you can spread the latest message of God, that you've been lucky enough to be born into a family that has this message and you should be happy to share it. So I always felt guilty for not sharing it, but I did not want to be different.
Your sister Rani was closest in age to you. Did the two of you share a room?
We did share a room at one stage. We did share a room. And I remember that she, because she was 9 years older, and much, much cooler, obviously, than me, she did at one point get a roll of masking tape and tape down the middle of the room so that I would not besmirch her side of the room.
What were the most covetable items or aspects of her side of the room?
Oh, she had a diary that I loved to look at because she was very crafty and, you know, in the 80s, I think this was a real thing to sort of scrapbook your diary with little, she would cut out little hearts and things that would sort of boing out of the diary on little folded up bits of paper. I just thought it was the most wonderful thing. She had a cassette player, like a tape player. She had great things. She had great clothes. She had great lipstick. She was just cool.
Where were you sent when she had her boyfriend over?
So by the time she got to the boyfriend, my eldest sister had moved out, so I had my own room, but I would still love to go into hers because it was way better than mine, but I was sent out and the door was shut. Thanks very much. But I would lie on the floor outside the door in the hallway that I first remembered when you said, what do you remember of this house? I remember this carpeted hallway, and I would lie down on the floor of the hallway and put my ear to the carpet and just try and squint under the gap in the door just to see what was going on in there. And I didn't, in my young mind, I never would have thought anything untoward was going on. I just really wanted to be part of the team, you know. So, and I would get little bits, balls of paper and flick them under there just to garner some attention until she would come out and rage at me.
What happened in the summer of 1989?
In the summer of 1989, my sister and her boyfriend Ashley, who was an angelic boy, and their friends went to a U2 concert in Brisbane. And when they were driving back from the U2 concert, they were all asleep in the back of the car. Rani was asleep. Ashley was asleep. And the teenager that was driving the car also fell asleep. And the car went off the road and hit a tree. And my sister was taken to the hospital and she was in a coma. And my mother and father had to make the decision of whether to turn off her life support or not, and they decided to do that.
What do you remember of the funeral?
I remember the funeral being at the Garden of Remembrance in Toowoomba, which is actually a beautiful cemetery where the plaques are laid into the grass, flat into the grass. But I remember being close to my aunt, my auntie Mary, my mother's eldest sister, and I remember her sari, which was a scarlet colour with gold on the edges. And I remember I had a pink dress on and some shoes that were very tight. I was only 8 years old, so I don't remember a lot, but I remember that my shoes were very uncomfortable. And I'd said to my auntie Mary, who had pulled me up onto her lap, I said, "My feet are hot." And she said, "Take your shoes off and put your feet on the grass." And so I took my shoes off and I put my feet on the grass, and I remember the grass feeling cold. And I looked at my aunt and she looked at me and she put her hand like a fist next to her chest and she said, "We have to be strong like this." And she held her fist up and I looked into her eyes and I nodded and I thought, okay.
How did your aunts, your mum's three sisters, help support the family in the aftermath of your sister's death?
They showed up, as they always do. So my mother has three older sisters. So my auntie Mary is very much an older sister, and if anyone listening has an older sister, you'll know what they're like. So she took charge of things. She cleaned the house. She welcomed visitors. Actually, I found out years later when I was speaking to my oldest sister, Lisa, that she came back to the house when my mother and father had gone away. They went away to Singapore after Rani died. My dad thought it would be good for Mum to go away for a while. And my Auntie Mary showed up at that time and she said to my sister, Lisa, "Okay, now we have to clean out the bedroom. We have to take everything out of here and pack it all up and put it away while your mum's away." And so my eldest sister did that with my Auntie Mary. Two elder sisters banded together to take charge of a situation. The next eldest sister, whose name is Mona, and she is a wild and woolly woman. She came and she's a very spiritual person. She's connected to all the loving forces in the world, and all she did was pray. I remember her holding me and praying. And she, my Auntie Mona, has lived for a long time up in the Torres Strait and in North Queensland, and she always wears these big muumuus with hibiscus flowers on them, and she's worn them 100 times. You know, I rocked up to her house a few years ago and she had one that had been torn down the side, and she'd sort of safety pinned it up, but she's just sort of pillowy and lovely, and she would sort of scoop you up, and she prayed a lot. And my Auntie Ira, she is a magnificent cook, and she came and she fed everybody. and just cooked up a storm.
You've mentioned what an important figure your grandma was in the house. How did your relationship with her change as you became a teenager?
Well, she was the type of grandmother who's very, I mean, she grew up in India, even though she's ethnically not Indian, she's culturally had that feeling about her, in that she would follow me everywhere and feed me with her hand. She would never want me, I would never have to do anything in particular other than just exist and be myself, and she would just follow after me. And if I was hungry, she'd put food in my mouth, and so long as she knew where I was, she was happy with me to do exactly what it was that took my fancy, which was great for me. I mean, what a way to grow up.
Great, but also a burden, I imagine, in some ways. At some point as a teenager, a grandmother standing by ready to put food in your mouth.
Well, yes. I mean, she would, when I got a little bit older, she really needed to know where I was. And this was the mid-90s and there was no mobile phones. So we didn't have mobile phones so she could call. She would have loved a mobile phone. I often think how thrilled she would be with something like Find My iPhone.
She could track you always.
Where she could have a live tracker. My mum has a live tracker and she blesses it every day. She's taken the baton. She loves it. But she would have absolutely adored being able to see where everyone in the family was at every point in time. She would have been the happiest woman on the block. But she couldn't. So she would do things like call the cinema.
So call the cinema?
Oh, she'd call the cinema and say, oh, hello, you know, I'm Dolly and I'm just wondering if my granddaughter is there. And they'd go, well, who is your granddaughter? And we had a little coffee shop in there. It was called Aromas. She would call Aromas and I would be sitting there sort of trying to be cool with my friends, and the barista would come over and go, is anyone here, Sita? And I go, yeah, that's me. Go, oh, your grandma's on the phone. She just wants to know when you'll be home. Yep, it was pretty harrowing.
Well, I guess the loss of Rani must have made, it's not surprising that there was anxiety, even more heightened anxiety about the safety of these precious grandchildren.
Definitely.
Your grandma Dolly, what part did eggs play in your grandma's efforts to keep you safe?
Well, she didn't want anyone to put the evil eye on me. And the evil eye is sort of just anyone who might look at you in a way that is jealous, perhaps, because she thought that I was so wonderful, that of course, why wouldn't people be looking at me in a jealous way going, oh, she's so beautiful and clever. Of course we would want to cast wickedness upon her. So my grandmother would take an egg, and it's actually called oomency, but she never called it anything, and she would run the egg up and down my arms and around my head, circle it around my head, and the egg is meant to draw the evil eye out of a person. So draw any wickedness that's in there that someone might have cast upon me, you know, draw it up out of me. And then she would take the egg to the back steps, and Bridge Street was a big old Queenslander on stumps, and we had a long set of steps going down to the backyard, and there were some pavers there that John always liked to weed and make sure that they were really neat and tidy, and that and Dolly would throw the egg off and it would smash on the pavers, because it's very important that you smash the wickedness out of the egg, break the shell.
How did your dad John feel about this?
He did not like it at all. He was highly irritated by the vanquishing of wickedness on the back pavers. He would come out with the hose. He'd hose it off. He'd say, this is ridiculous. It's superstition. It doesn't mean anything.
You went off to a Baha'i youth camp when you were a teenager, Sita. Who did you meet there?
I met my husband, the man who was to be my future husband. His name is Borhan.
How quickly did you realise that this was someone that you were going to make that kind of commitment to?
I think he was sort of more certain than I was in the beginning, but I really liked him because he was so passionate about being a Baha'i. He was so very smart. He was at the youth camp to run some sessions. And they were on sort of the history and philosophy of the Baha'i faith. They were really interesting. I thought he had a unique perspective on many things. And, yeah, we slowly fell in love and got married.
Was there any part of you as a teenager that wanted to break away from this family faith that, you know, you'd been raised in?
Yes, I think it's so interesting that there were so many parts of me that wanted to break away, but I would never admit those parts to myself because I really, truly, truly believed that the Baha'i faith was the absolute be-all and end-all of faiths. So I think that it was never an option with me at that point, and I always thought that I would want to marry someone who was a Baha'i, even though the boys that I had liked in high school were never Baha'is. They were never religious at all. I've always had these two sort of forces pulling at me, I think.
You and Borhan had three kids together. How did you first become aware that his own relationship to the religion was changing?
I think it happened slowly over time. He began to become interested in other things. He had some issues with the Baha'i faith that he would discuss with me and with his family. And I think all of a sudden it came to a point when we were about 28 where he sort of said, I just don't believe this anymore.
How did that strike you at the time?
It worried me. I was worried. I was worried about it because, you know, this is people's souls we're dealing with. When you're a person of great faith, you're thinking about not just the now, you're thinking about your everlasting soul.
How did his new way of living rub off on you?
Baha'is, for example, don't drink alcohol. Smoking is frowned upon, but it is not, you know, outlawed in any way. But they don't drink. They don't have sex before marriage. They don't, obviously, backbite, although I'd definitely done a bit of that. they don't take drugs. Yeah, they're, which is common to many religions and not just the Baha'i faith, but it was a strong thing in my house. So throughout all my teenage years, I never had a drop of alcohol, not at any party, not anywhere. So I thought, I'll give that a go, because I'd always kind of pictured myself as being this, you know, fantastic bohemian artist and, you know, with a glass of red wine in my hand and, you know, gaily smoking at parties and whatnot. And that kind of lifestyle was very glamorous to me. And I sort of thought, well, I'm going to give red wine a go because Borhan had, you know, partaken. He was sort of free of everything at that point and so was trying things out. And I just thought, you know what, stuff it. I'm going to give it a go. I'm 28 years old. I don't really think that God is sitting up there watching me. I'm not interesting enough. I'll have a sip. It was disgusting. I spat it out in the sink. It's not a starter beverage, red wine, for those who have not partaken.
Was that the end of your experimentations with alcohol?
It was for a while. It was for a while the end of my experimentations. But then I dabbled after that. I dabbled in all of the things, really. One thing that I dropped, which I think was more difficult and I felt more rebellious than anything to do with alcohol or cigarette or any of that kind of stuff, was the prayer. I really felt bound to pray in the morning and evening, and I would feel extremely guilty if I didn't, to the point where if I lay down and I hadn't said my prayers, even if I was completely exhausted, and one often is with two small kids, I would force myself to sit up because you always want to sit respectfully as well when you pray. It's not something that you do lying down. And I let go of that. I went to bed one night and I said, I'm not doing it. And I fell asleep. And then when I woke up in the morning, I felt really good. I felt like that was me. I'd made a choice on my own. It just felt like a tiny freedom. And then I wanted more of that, really.
You and Borhan decided to end your marriage. How did your parents react when you rang to tell them that?
Oh, It was very, very, very difficult to tell them that because they have such a strong marriage themselves and because obviously Baha'is believe in marriage. They knew that things were not good. But I called them and I told them, look, we've decided to separate. And I was really struggling. I was at home. The kids were at school, but I decided, you know, I'm not going to go to work that day because I just couldn't get myself out of the bed because I was, for the first time in my life, having to organise everything by myself. You know, I wanted to change my name back. I needed to organise the Medicare. I needed to have my separate bank account. I needed to rent a house. I needed to all of these things that I'd never done because I basically went from my father's house to my husband's house and I'd always had help in that way. So I called my mum and dad up in tears and I said, please just come. Please just come here and help me. And Dad said, yep, we'll be there. We'll be there in a couple of hours. I just need to probably have to go to the bank or something. It's a classic John.
Just a little bit of weeding and then I'm going
to
be there.
I just need to get out the nut grass and then I'll be there. So they hopped in the car. They came to Brisbane and I was under the covers and they came into my room and my dad sort of sat on the bed with me. My mum sat on the bed with me. My mum was in a real flap, actually. She was... You asked me before about how mum deals in a crisis. Not well is the answer. So she was sort of flapping about the house and Dad said, oh, Fari, stop flapping around and make her a cup of tea, for goodness sake. And I'll have one too while you're at it. So she went off and she made tea and Dad sort of gave me a hug and I told him all my worries. And then mum come back in with the tea and she said, oh, well... You know, I'm going to say a prayer. Let's sit down and say some prayers and everything will be okay. And Dad sort of said, well, your mother's going to pray and then I'm going to call Medicare. So they did a good team effort on getting me back on my feet.
You moved out of the home that you and your husband had shared into your own place. How did that little rental house feel to you?
The little rental house felt great, actually, for a while. It was exciting to have my very own place for the first time ever. And I felt just the lifting of resentment. I think when you've been in a relationship for a long time that is struggling, there can be a real heavy feeling and heavy energy that surrounds everything. And that was just lifted off me because I didn't feel observed in any way by anyone and I kind of wasn't even observing myself. So I just did the things that I wanted to do and it was a lot of work, but I wasn't resenting anyone for not helping or I wasn't resenting anyone, the kids or anyone. So it was an emancipation in a way. I felt terrific.
In those heady days of early freedom, Sita, how did you want to spend your time? What did you want to do?
Oh, I really wanted to watch television. Like I really, really wanted to watch TV. There were so many shows that I had missed and I love TV and films. So I watched a lot of telly and it was wonderful. And I wanted to just eat. I was very, very thin and I wanted to eat what I wanted to eat. You know, now they have a term now for what I was doing and they've called it girl dinner. It's a new thing and I've seen it online. The kids do it. They're like, girl dinner. It's when, you know, you eat an egg and a piece of asparagus and a biscuit and you're like, that's my dinner. I just wanted to eat what I wanted when I wanted. Yeah, it was wonderful.
After the end of your marriage, Sita, were you keen to meet someone else?
No, I was not. It felt like that's a really big thing and that would take a lot of energy and time. And I wanted to have fun, but I did not want to be in love and have a relationship. I wanted to have fun like I never got to have in my 20s.
So what approach did you take to dating in your late 30s?
I went on Bumble And I was horrified myself that I was going on Bumble, but I was only on there for 24 hours, so I feel like Bumble should give me some kind of an award and a little trophy or something.
You're not good for their business model. If it only took 24 hours, you're the last person they should be giving an award to. Well, what happened in that?
I won Bumble.
Yeah.
I went on and I picked one person because I saw that he was an actor and I thought, well, we'll have something to talk about. You know, actors can talk. And I thought he can use a possessive apostrophe, which was very important to me, and he's an actor. So I chose him, and then later that evening I, you know, contacted him, or he contacted me anyway, because I'm not sure how Bumble works, because as I said, I was on there for a very short amount of time. But we chatted and we decided to meet.
And how quickly did that delightful romance with that actor become something serious?
Very quickly, in an upsettingly quick amount of time. I fell in love, which was very upsetting to me. I didn't want that to happen. And he fell in love with me.
Even worse.
Even worse. Dreadful. If he hadn't, then I would have had a get out of jail free card. Oh, well, he hates me. But no. And then he was sort of in flux because he was living in Brisbane, but he just moved from Sydney and he was living in a kind of Airbnb style situation. And then things happened in my life where Borhan decided to move out west and live on a property. And he asked the kids, you know, who wants to come with me? And my eldest daughter sort of went, you know, no thanks, the farming life's not for me. And the boys went, absolutely, Dad, let's go. So they went to live out west, and all of a sudden I had this empty house, just me and my daughter, and the lovely actor that I had met had nowhere to live. And so I said, well, why don't you just come live with us? And it felt like the most natural thing in the world, the easiest thing to say, the easiest thing to do, and it was.
So at this point, you were now living with a man who wasn't your husband. Mm-hmm. You were drinking, you discovered red wine was okay,
very bad.
Occasional cigarette.
Both very bad.
Not saying your daily prayers.
No.
Were you thinking of yourself as a Baha'i?
I wasn't actually thinking of myself as a Baha'i. I was thinking that I had no religion. I hadn't said that I was anything. I certainly wasn't an atheist, and I wasn't any other religion. I just wasn't anything. I just didn't say anything. I went silent on the topic and just did what I liked for a while.
Was that something that you avoided discussing with your family, or how did it play out with your mum and dad and extended family?
Yes, I absolutely avoided discussing it. But when you move a man into your house that you're not married to, the secret somehow manages to get out. So
how did that conversation go with them?
Well, I realised that I had to say something, not only because I'd moved a man into my house, but because I was writing a memoir, and I thought, I'm going to have to come clean with John and Fari, and I'm going to have to tell them, you know, I'm not sure whether I believe this anymore. And the issue that I had was, when I boiled it down to the core issue that I had, it was nothing to do with what I could do and what I couldn't do, or even with the praying or anything like that. It was, I just wasn't sure whether, had I been born with no religion, would I have become a Baha'i? Would I have seen this faith like my dad saw this faith and converted and known that this was for him? Would I have known that it was for me? I don't know that, because I was never given the opportunity to be a blank slate. I think it's really important for children to be blank slates, to grow up in a way where they are nurtured and loved, but also they don't feel like they have to choose the path of their parents, that they can be whatever it is that their soul tells them they should be doing and being and believing. And I just didn't know. And how could I know? Because I grew up in such a strong, faithful family. So I had to come clean and tell John and Fari that.
How did they respond?
Well, I wasn't so much worried about Mum, and I wasn't so much even wanting to say anything to Mum, because we sort of protect Fari because we don't like her to be hurt by anything, because she's had so many difficult things. I mean, Rani passing away was not the only terrible young death that she had experienced in her life. So we like to look after Mum. Dad's a bit more robust. So I wanted to tell Dad, but also because he's so principled, I didn't want him to feel like I was throwing my upbringing back in his face. You know, they did a great job. I grew up in a very loving home. But I wanted to be honest, and that's difficult for me because I also like to be pleasing people. So I went to Toowoomba, took the kids, and Mum was, you know, Mum was telling me, you need to get married. You need to marry Anthony. And I said, I'm not doing that again, Mum. I'm not doing it, because it was very stressful to leave a marriage. And I don't think there's any need to do it. I don't feel like it's a necessary thing for me to do in my life. I feel like I'm committed in the way that I'm committed. And I know from this, the shifting sands of my faith, how things can change, how people can change, and how beliefs can change and life situations can change. And I'm just not interested in signing any forms at this point in my life. Thanks very much. So I was cross with her. I was a little bit cross with Mum because she was pushing about the getting married thing. And so I sort of stormed down to Dad's office, and Dad's always in his office and he's always got the classical music playing. So he was listening to some Mozart or whatever. And I said, Dad, I just want to come and tell you that I'm not going to be getting married again. And I must have said it in a way that interrupted him from what he was doing, because he turned off the CD player and he swiveled his desk chair around and he said, what? And I said, I'm just letting you know, in case you've got any ideas about me getting married again, in case you're of the opinion that I need to get married again, I'm not going to be doing that. Mum seems to think I am, and you need to talk to your wife about it because she's not listening to me. And he said, why don't we have a cup of tea, dear? And so we got up and went into the kitchen, and because I was feeling a little bit emboldened, I thought, look, now's the time. I'm just going to tell him. And, you know, he was busy making me the tea and asking about milk and sugar. And I said, Dad, I just have to tell you that. And I sort of started to get nervous then when it started to come out of my mouth. I said, look, I'm not sure whether I want to be a Baha'i anymore. I'm not sure whether I believe in everything that you believe anymore. And I love you and I love the way you raise me, but I'm just not sure whether it's right for me. And I don't know, because I've always been raised in this way and I can't ever get perspective unless I come away from it. And I'm sorry, and I feel like you're going to love me less, but I just have to tell you that I don't believe anymore. We were sitting down on the couch and I was teary at this stage. And he said, my precious treasure, Baha'is believe that a person's faith is conditioned by no one but themselves. It is not my business. It's your business, what you believe. And he said, and I will always love you, my darling, no matter what you do. And I was very upset at that point, so he gave me his handkerchief, which was always very neatly folded and ironed and in his top pocket.
Upset?
Not upset. I just felt emotional and nervous because it had been such a difficult thing to say, and then relieved that he had been so generous about it. But I know that it would have been difficult for him to hear.
Did he get your mum to lay off you with the wedding plans?
Oh, look, I'm sure the man's tried. I'm sure he's tried his darndest, but it's very hard to get Fari to be anything other than Fari.
She'd encouraged you back when you were at high school to be a teacher like her, But in your heart of hearts, Sita, what did you always kind of feel your vocation was?
I wanted to be an artist of some sort. I really loved musical theatre. I loved music. When I was in grade 7 at Toowoomba East State School, it was my dream to be the majorette of the Toowoomba East State School Marching Fife Band, which was bestowed upon me. They bestowed the mace upon me.
If I'd known that, that would have been in the introduction. I apologise.
I know. It was a really high point, and I'm shocked that we haven't talked about it earlier. But from then on, I just got the bug of being a performer, being a leader. I loved music. I played all of the instruments. I sang in all the choirs. I played in all the bands. I did all the plays that I possibly could. And I really wanted an artistic life to be the life for me in some way. I loved storytelling. I loved being the one to share something with someone. And I think that's why I found gossip so interesting and so wonderful, because it was a story, a really interesting story. So that's what I wanted. I didn't want to be a teacher.
But you did become one and are still a teacher.
Yes.
And my hunch is you're probably a really great teacher.
Well, thank you. I always think about that story where John Lennon's asked whether Ringo Starr is the best drummer in the world. And he says, Ringo Starr's not even the best drummer in the Beatles. Like, I'm not even the best teacher in my staff room. Definitely not my school. Like, I think I'm good, but I'm, you know, I'm not working miracles.
Well, alongside your teaching, you've become a writer that you'd imagined yourself being from this young age, this memoir that you published a few years ago, and now a novel called In a Common Hour, which is set in a high school. So this is kind of marrying these two parts of you, Sita. What bits of your experience as a teacher have found their ways into the novel?
Interestingly, I think all of them. So everything that I've done over 20 years as a teacher and all the things that I've learnt, but not learnt as in how to teach in a classroom. I mean, I've definitely learnt that too. But I think what you really learn as a teacher is how to see what's going to happen before it happens, how to read the connections between people in the room, the energy that's in the room, how to shift things so that whatever happens in the classroom goes the way that you want it to go. I've brought what it is to be in front of those kids every day and kind of be connected to them.
Can you tell me about the role that a poem by Mary Oliver played in one of your English classes?
So a few years ago, I had a fantastic class of kids. It was a literature class. They were really interesting kids, outgoing, smart. So the energy in the room was sassy, like it was heightened. When you get a whole lot of smart, bookish kids in a room, then it can go either to a really sort of introverted energy, or you can just have everything come out at once. And they were like that. They were big and bold and interesting. And I wanted them to love the subject. And I thought, well, this will be the class to do this with. And I asked them to memorize a poem because I knew that there was a real competitive edge to the room and they would do it just to see if they could outdo each other. And they did. And the poem that I asked them to memorize was Wild Geese by Mary Oliver, which begins, "You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting," which obviously speaks to me and I thought could speak to other young people. And they took to this with great flight. They not only did they learn it off by heart, they could recite it together. You know, a wall of sound coming at you. You do not have to be good. I'm getting emotional thinking about it now because it was so affecting to me to see these young people love what this woman had done. Mary Oliver is a sublime poet and they loved it so much that I see them. Sometimes I see them, you know, you see kids, you come across them. They've all long graduated now and they will come up and they'll say, oh, Miss, I can still say that poem, or that is the only poem I know because you made us learn it. And one girl, her name was Cameron, such a beautiful girl, she embroidered a book bag for me, but she, it took her so long that she came back to give it to me the following year. And the book bag was embroidered with words from the last stanza of the poem, two lines which say, "Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination." And, oh, I just, it just crushed me. I thought, this is what it means. This is the reward you get for being a teacher.
Well, you know, just like some Beatles fans have Ringo as their favourite, clearly some English students, Sita, despite your protestations, you must have made quite an impact. Yeah, as you say, that beautiful poem with that amazing line, "You do not have to be good," spoke to you, speaks to you. It's interesting. It's not like not being good means you be bad. How do you understand the relieving of that burden of being good? What comes in its place?
I think, strangely, that the thing that relieved the anxiety of being good, and it wasn't even the goodness that I had an issue with. I mean, goodness is very interesting. I love to see goodness in people and wonder, where has that light come from? It wasn't that I didn't want to be good. It's what, that I wanted to lose the anxiety surrounding the shoulds. You should do this. You should be like that. You should be like this. And I think really that the opposite of anxiety is of that anxiety is not to be bad, but to be creative. So I think that any sort of creativity that I did, and it really came to me. So it came to me when I was writing the memoir. It came to me in the classroom. At any moment where I felt that anxiety, I would think, okay, if I'm creative in this moment, it will go away. And it has. It sort of leads to, I think creativity in people leads to a truthfulness that is deep, deep inside us.
Sita, it has been a real treasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you, Sarah. It's been my pleasure. I've listened to you for so long. I love your show. Thank you.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky.
Sita Walker's new novel is called In a Common Hour, and her memoir is titled God of No Good. This conversation was produced by Alice Moldovan and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanofsky. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.